I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. On Pot of Gold, we are not climate crisis deniers.
No, we're not.
But we often think of climate change as a new challenge that humanity is facing. But that's not necessarily true. In fact, the climate has changed in very dramatic ways over the past 6 million years of human existence.
Through the geological periods known as the Miocene, Pliocene, and Pleistocene, aka the Ice Age, humanity witnessed extreme changes in the temperature, landscape, and oceans of planet Earth. The question is, how can we apply our knowledge of that history to the challenges we face with the climate crisis today?
In this episode, we are speaking with Veli Albert Kallio, an ethnoclimatologist who's been using indigenous recollections of climate change to better understand where we are in the climate crisis and what we should expect to see in the future.
I'm Veli Albert Kallio, and back in 1980s, I was doing lots of work with studying physics and researching and proposed a novel particle detector. And I always wanted to do that type of work, but then I realized a couple of years later that there was Jim Hansen giving U.S. congressional testimony on global warming, and then I thought that, oh boy, it's better that those galaxies and black holes can help themselves, but our climate cannot. And then I started to work on the climate change issues and sea level rise.
So you switched from aerospace to working on climate change. What skills did you bring? Where did you focus in the climate change conversation?
I was initially invited to set up this kind of like exhibition on the ethnic recollections of the past climates and sea level flooding and all that in Turkey. And that was my first project on this field in 1995. And then after that, I focused several years for the sea ice because I realized that it had been underestimated how badly the sea ice was thinning first. And more recently, it has started to lose its sea ice area, which is the more meaningful because the sunlight is much more absorbed.
Okay, so there's basically two areas. One is the ancient civilizations and the impact of climate in the very far past, and whatever your lessons we could learn from that. And then your second is the sea ice reduction. So let's start with the ancient civilizations and what you learned by looking back in time.
Basically, in April 2009, the United Nations had a meeting with indigenous people, and the Environmental Parliament Group was raising the issue, and they came to agreement with UN General Assembly President that there is a paleo future climate risk class events, which is meaning kind of events that during this Holocene stable climate, you don't see this kind of natural phenomena occurring at all. And we have very little idea what might happen. But then when you disturb the climate system, it finds these ghosts coming from the ground. And there are many kinds of these type of things, like very strong St. Elmo's lights and very strong series of earthquake swarms and super volcanoes and also kind of like large areas of ocean might be also flooded by hot rocks and causing the ocean to vaporize, and also methane explosions and all. So there are lots of things that hasn't happened yet, and there is still potential for these things to start happening. And one good example of these things that happened in ancient time is that like the 1900 Krakatau eruption in Indonesia, the St. Elmo's lights were seen much more widely across the world. And what that means that trees and people and animals, they can have this blue light glowing on them or from them. And that is something to do with this electrostatical phenomena that are occurring during these very large volcanic eruptions. and it changes, that you become kind of like a neon light, you see. And I never even thought about this, but then I was reading Wikipedia has a very interesting article about St. Elmo's lights. And then I started to realize that in the ancient times, when these volcanic eruptions were much, much more bigger, these things were really common. And people were therefore, when they saw glowing trees and glowing animals, they saw all kind of spirits behind these glowing lights. But when Krakatau eruption happened, it was some people were almost like glowing everywhere with this blue light, you see. And that is an example of what paleofuture climate change risk class is, that something totally unexpected thing happens.
Can you explain how the recollection from the past might change our interpretation of what's happening in our future? So what's happening with the climate of today?
One of these ethnoclimatological recollections was the one that was presented in the aftermath of Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit in 1992. So there are different versions how the climate change has unfolded in the past that are strongly indicating that there's something wrong with the current models. And it is generally the tendency is that it's far worse than the better. And we also archaeological evidences are now turning up. Like, for example, the Giza's Great Pyramid recently was radiocarbon dated for the 34th century. And we know it exactly what year it was built. And there was some 802 or 902 years of extra radiocarbon loss appearing. And this is most likely because during the Ice Age and early Holocene, the first sea level fell down, the methane class rates and the gas fields were outgassing ancient geological carbon from the geological processes as a side product. And then when methane went up, it warmed up the climate and it caused the Holocene thermal maximum or Holocene thermal optimum, which was basically the same as the permafrost melting maximum. And this again releasing carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide into atmosphere. And because of this carbon is ancient carbon, the early Holocene and early history period, there is this inflation of time. And the question now is how much inflation of time did occur? And according to indigenous peoples, UN General Assembly motion, that is enormous amount of inflation in time that did happen with this thing, which only means that our glaciers will respond a lot faster than those models that the West has indicated. And anything that is then calibrated against radiocarbon can get off the track as well, because it was the mileposts were set by radiocarbon. So this early Holocene issue is a big problem and Pleistocene, because this gas is from the rocks and melting permafrost may have changed the natural portfolio of the ratio of carbon. And then you also had the cold oceans mopping the atmospheric carbon-14 much faster than now. So the time scales are actually contracting. And this is one of the key issues why this First Nations motion is so important, because it means that we have less time than we have been led to believe. And it's not intentional, it is just totally unintentional, but I think that is the problem, you see, that these kind of things we don't have a leeway at all, you see. And when big accidents happen, they often happen that there are lots of things that could have been done better. And when everything is not done so well, then in the end the togetherness of these factors play badly out themselves, and then the whole thing collapses, and then we get a really bad accidents. And I think with the nature, this is the same thing, but there's nothing more that can be put on the credit card of the polluting environment to make some economic savings in short term. That road is now end, and there is no way around this.
That's a really great explanation, and it makes very clear the urgency of this situation. Yeah.
There are really nice stories what could be put into video and look at it, which really are very, very interesting stories. And some of them are so detailed as well that you just have to read it. You can't just make a program. There is some sea level retreats that are recorded so, so detailed with different water systems, how they have been changed. And all of this sits down in those archives. There is hundreds of miles of different archives in the museums and institutions and historic institutions. And so there are a lot of good material sitting down from medieval times, from antiquity and even prehistoric things when one goes very deeply into it.
Where might we find those kind of archives?
I was presenting for a conference in Switzerland, which was there was a specialist conference on this topic called CRIAS, Climate Recollections in Archives of Societies, CRIAS, at University of Bern's Climate Change Oesker Center of Climate Change. And there was a conference and I presented them. And there is the Sunetas ethnohistory of the Ice Ages, the 1962 Oxford edition by University of Oxford Press and the UK Paleo Society, which is quite interesting description how the sea level was retreating when the glaciers were growing. And this is all driving the idea that what the First Nations have been pushing, that these volcanic eruptions were boiling the ocean and causing these large snowfalls, which seems to be a different theory to the currently popular theory in the West of the how the Ice Age was took place. So basically, also the Old Norse histories talk about the fighting ice giants and fire giants. And when you have a big volcano spilling large quantities of lava, you get the ocean boiling. And in the winter darkness, this water vapor then falls elsewhere as a snow, forming very, very strong deposits.
So what would be the conditions that would bring about this kind of volcanic, super volcanic explosion? What are we looking at in terms of today?
I think the biggest risk is places like, for example, you have like Iceland losing large amounts of ice from Vatnajökull would be one thing that could cause quite big explosion. But even bigger potential would be that if the Greenland ice sheet would somehow start weakening chemically, its crystal structure as it warms up and collapse, then the ground would be rebounding very fast. And the under glacier conduits of volcanic conduits and those things are unknown, except that it is thought that it is extinct on the southeast Greenland, those volcanoes across the Icelandic. But I wouldn't put all my coins on it, because if the ice starts losing its pressure very, very rapidly, then the gases within the volcanic liquid starts nucleating and the gas bubbles are forming these are the ones that make the magma volume to increase, and then it will squirt it out under the ice sheet and possibly also on the seabed and all of that, you see. So this is, but in Antarctic, there's another possibility, especially Western Antarctic. Maybe Pine Island glacier is already facing something similar, that there are increasing numbers of volcanic eruptions releasing heat that is melting the Pine Island glacier. Basically, equilibrium between the East Antarctic and West Antarctic, if it grows bigger, so that the West Antarctic ice sheet melts and loses its weight, whereas the East Antarctic is gathering weight. This equilibrium could drive also fluids within Earth's crust moving from the east towards the west, where the pressures are releasing, and then as a result you would find volcanic eruptions. And this could become so serious that they might be runaway events, that the more the volcano erupts, the more ice it melts, and the more bubbles within the volcanic liquid it forms. And then there's no end until the glacier is disappeared. So this could be kind of like extreme scenario that might happen.
Yeah, I guess that's extreme.
I'm a little bit speechless. So this is, when we talk about climate change, usually we're thinking about droughts and floods. But what you're talking about is a whole nother dimension of potential damage to the Earth's surface. What would it look like?
The climate change is a very interesting phenomenon, of course, and all the meteorologists and climatologists are very much interested in it. And it has been basically branded this way, that there is a dangerous climate change. Then it is next severe step is catastrophic climate change. And then the next severe is terminal climate change, which is kind of like a runaway global warming that will turn Earth like a Venus-like planet. So let's look first at the dangerous climate change. That is kind of phenomena that causes a major forest fires and major floodings and disasters, but which are not perhaps, you can't compare it to destruction yet with a nuclear bomb. But it is dangerous is that it is putting lives at risk considerably. Catastrophic climate change, I would start saying, is like this thing, that the climate change damage is exceeding the economic growth of the world economy. And when the climate destruction of economic value is greater than the wealth creation, then everybody is starting to appear poorer in the world. And I would put this one as a catastrophic climate change, but that wouldn't mean end of the mankind necessarily, but it would make us poorer, because then there is real runaway climate change, like happened in Venus many, many millions of years ago. The runaway climate change happens like this way, that clouds are very good sunlight reflectants, but on the other hand, they also are very good mirrors to send back to the surface the long wave radiation, the infrared radiation, the heat radiation. But now if the atmospheric system gets more and more moist, and you have the entire night side of the world covered by clouds, then the heat of the Earth cannot sufficiently escape, and then the ocean starts vaporizing. And that is the terminal climate change, because then you end up with a climate that everything goes so dark, because there is so dark and thick clouds that you can't see through. Air pressure goes higher and water content goes higher and floods goes higher, and you can end up with the huge hailstorms with very, very heavy hail starting to fall down and demolish. And it comes like a kind of apocalyptic scheme almost. And from this kind of thing, you would say that this is a terminal climate change. So it is no good idea that if the whole sky was covered by the white clouds, because then it would mean that also night side would be, because during the night side, the Earth is disbanding and discharging excess heat back to space.
And this has happened before?
This has happened in Venus, and some people are thinking that as that might happen here now because of the tinkering of the atmospheric system with various greenhouse gases, and also because the sun is gradually getting stronger and stronger because it is growing. That's the sun is in the mainline star, but then it gradually turns into this big giant, and you can't compare something what happened 600 million years ago to the present situation, because if you do the same thing now, the sunlight is stronger, so it affects differently.
Okay, so what is, you know, given this this horrifying potential future, what is your advice? What do you think we should be doing as human beings to mitigate or steer in a different direction?
I think that all of it comes from the very basic solution. And I think all the homes should be insulated so that they use the minimum amount of energy, and they should have solar panels. And people should be perhaps asked more to do teleworking from the home. And also, I think perhaps work time initiatives, VTIs, should be deployed more broadly across the world. VTIs are work time initiatives that the traveling to work is made as payable working hours, that then the government treasury is reimbursing to the companies and employers. And then it is collected, the money is collected from pollutants, drivers and whoever. And then it makes socially more acceptable and more preferential to use buses, trains and other means than commuting long distances every day to work with car. So this is one way. Electrifying also car is very good idea, what Elon Musk is doing, and very, very great thanks to him taking it that far. But it is, I am a concern of the capacity constraints, because whether they have enough lithium for everybody, how long it takes to supply the lithium, how is the distribution of electricity networks, And how do you produce that electricity to drive those cars? There are all these issues. Nuclear energy has its own issues. You can't infinitely increase the production capacity. Every year you maybe increase maybe 20%, 15%, 30%, but you cannot infinitely increase it. So there has to be a portfolio of solutions like this, and maybe recycling, and absolutely must stop dumping solid waste into the seas through the rivers, what some poor countries like Egypt has been doing, that they are just skipping lorry loads of rubbish into the river Nile, which is take them to the sea, which is absolutely the wrong way to do, because the ocean, last 15 years, the ocean has been filling up really fast rate with all kind of floating rubbish.
I mean, those solutions sound like ones we know exist, you know, insulating homes and putting on solar panels and electrifying cars and having people commute less. Those are pretty common sense initiatives, although we haven't managed to do them very well, very quickly.
To be precise, we basically had technology already in the 80s, and then, you know, President Reagan, for example, came into office, and it's like almost like a reverse switch, yeah, which goes on in society, where solar panels are deinstalled and everything is shifting towards oil. But the technology is there, but it's the matter of how to use it, in my opinion.
Or how to get people to change their mind in unison, so to speak. How do we get everyone doing the right thing at the same time? And I guess the question I have is, are you hopeful that we can make these changes quickly enough to avoid catastrophic climate change?
Well, I think it is a very, very difficult question that I really have a feeling that there is not a clear answer. But I think you see, such a severe consequence of the Arctic sea ice disappearing is this thing that it exposes the whole Arctic Ocean into the 24-hour sunlight in the summertime, which then attacks and melts away Greenland ice sheet, which leaves the dirt on the Greenland ice sheet on the top, which turns it black. And it then the meltwater runs into ice and stores the heat of the summer through the winter, and dissipating it into the ice and making it softer and weaker. And once this is gone, one of the biggest risks is this thing that the wintertime folding of the atmosphere over the North Pole, as the darkness comes to the North Pole, the air cools down and densifies over the North Pole and Arctic. And this process may stop, because if the sea ice doesn't form, the ocean water will release its heat into the atmosphere, which blocks this northward wintertime movement of the air from the equator. And for Asia, this is a really problem, because it is this wind to the northward that is pulling the Asian monsoon and the moisture from the sea over the ocean. And if it's cut away or reduced, what happens, because Earth rotates, those rains that are now falling into Asia may start falling into the Western Pacific Ocean instead, and dry air will take its place over the continent. And then this can only mean, is one thing, that it can mean global, almost like a World War III, because then if the West has acted too late, there is this prospect of of revenge, and the Asian countries are really putting all their efforts to nuclearize and arm themselves with nuclear weapons. China is getting 2,700 new nuclear weapons for global deployment, and India is increasing its own stocks. Then there are a number of undeclared states. And in addition to this, there is this geoengineering aspect called the nuclear winter. If you drop 260 atomic bombs or more on the Northern Hemisphere, you can call so-called nuclear winter. And this nuclear winter can refreeze Arctic Ocean and restart the monsoon. So there is all the win-win situation for Asia in some ways for it to go for a nuclear war. And this is reducing the nuclear threshold. So it can end up as a, like every existence since the man went to the fighting over the first water hole with the wooden clubs. This could come that we are coming to fight over the atmospheric resources with nuclear weapons and turn it to the kind of like a cataclysmic end for the mankind, even if the climate doesn't kill everybody.
Okay. And we just wondered if you have any final message you'd like to bring out to our audience regarding your work and how we could all work together to affect climate change.
I think we just need to do the simple things that are not so fancy things and persuade the politicians to act on them. And have a less politicians like Donald Trump that who don't seem to be caring very much of things, or Jair Bolsonaro, who is just mowing down the Amazon as fast as he can to get the dollars in the pocket and disappear. I don't know what planet he's going to go, whether he is in the moon or Mars.
Very good.
That is so true. Yeah, it's been interesting. I think you've given me it is true, Albert, that there, when we talk about climate change, it is very, sometimes it feels very repetitive. Yeah, there are always these kind of warning fingers and oh, don't do that, don't do this. And I think people are actually a little bit tired of it, you know, hearing always the same story. You have given me for the first time ever an explanation of stages of climate change. And that's actually very helpful. And yet, there are still people out there, and believe me, I have actually even met people who really do not believe that we live in an era of climate change. And that is sometimes very frustrating. And I personally don't know what to do with it. And I think, going to the moon is maybe, could be like just the ad of like, hey, you know, I don't know. Anyways, it's been good to talk to you, and I think we could dive more into history and all that. It's very interesting, you know. And in the end of the day, it's like, how are we going to do this? Because we are actually running out of time. And I really appreciate people like you who I think you said it was in the 80s where you thought, okay, let's the space can care for itself. Let's come here to Earth and like work on Earth's problems, and how to save it all. Turn around the wagon, so to say.
Thank you for doing that.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.